Hello and welcome to Rule of Carnage. This is a series of conversations between myself, Mike Hutchinson, a game designer, and this guy, Glenn Ford, also a games designer. And we are talking today, as we often do, about designing better miniature games. I read a book recently by P. Dunn. It was this charming hardback thing from 1970, Sea Battle Games. And in the introduction of this book, he's talking about the practice and the very novel practice of naval wargaming. And the way that he describes what the book that he's written is for and what people might do with it, I found really, really interesting. It got my mind racing about perhaps a tension that we still see in miniature games today, which I think Glenn and I have explored kind of personally in our own relationships with games, which is how complete should a rule system be, and for whom are incomplete rule systems for? And what this chap, I assume he's called Paul or Peter, I don't know, he never actually admits to a first name, I should go and find it out. But what Mr. Dunn says is that he sort of opens up by saying, well, here are some rules, explorations, and what you'll do with them is that you'll take them into your own DNA, and the rules that you play with at home will be maybe influenced by some of this. But the assumption underlying everything that he writes in this book is that there is no game. You play your game, I play my game, Steve plays his game, Glenn has his own game. We all have our own game. Like, we're all games designers. There's no miniature wargamer in the late 60s or the early 70s who isn't themselves a games designer, because at their table, it's their rules, and they have concluded what the right level of granularity is, and they've decided whether or not they're particularly interested in this, that, or the other, and they've got a table that's of a particular size, and they like a certain kind of component. And it's more like, you know, it's more like having a Sunday dinner at their house. It's like, well, they'll make the Sunday roast the way that they like to make it, and the gravy will be this way or whatever. Like, because there was nothing else. Like, you can get a couple of books, and you were reading one of them, Donald Featherston's War Games, and there's a couple a few years later, like Charles Grant's Battle, where, you know, they nudge in the direction of, here is a written rule system that you could potentially pick up, read, and then play without further intervention. But there aren't really any of those. And it's not until maybe like sort of Chainmail and early Warhammer, like first edition of Warhammer Fantasy Battle, that there's a product that you can buy that says everybody's allowed to buy this product and play exactly this game. And that starts a sort of separate evolutionary tree branch where there are games that are complete and are expected to be complete and are essentially presented as an experience that is complete. But it's not, I think, as simple as that, because thinking about this commentary from Mr. Dunn got me thinking about the way that, you know, people like Rick Priestley tend to introduce, particularly like late 80s and early 90s war games, where they all have inherent in them the sort of like, well, of course, what you'll do with this rule system is you'll invent the fun. And Glenn, you've talked about this with some passion, about the fact that if a game essentially says, dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum, here's some rules, but the last 20% is for you to figure out, and I don't know how you want to have fun, like, you figure it out. Like, that can be at the table extremely irritating. And when it's a board game that does that, like, I get ragey around that, where it's like, what, you've given me 80% of a board game, but you haven't told me what this component does, or you haven't told me what this mechanic is actually, or you've misreferenced something, so I can't really stick two things together. And like, the game, as we describe it, like, blue screens and just can't function. Whereas in this world, it's like, well, you just take some of these things as ingredients. And if you like the smell of that turmeric, then you maybe put it in your next dish. But
I mean, the thing of that is, I mean, the first thing it makes me think as a sort of a modern games player and a modern games designer is the absolute nerve, you know, that you would, as in like the confidence you would have to put out something like that now, I think would be like staggering. But there's something, Alex.
But Kennedy. I'm not sure I agree. I think there's a rich subculture of games that expect you to fill in the last 10 to 20%.
Well, this is it. I'm not sure about that in relation to tabletop games. So look, Alex Kennedy, in one of his game design books talks about, what we want to do is we want to write more pages because we write things. Mm. We want to offer people rules. And in defense of the fact that we might not really be any good at what we are doing, let's just give them extra pages, count the, feel the width, never mind the quality sort of thing.
Mm.
What I mean is that to write a game and to like leave dot, dot, dots and gaps in there is just kind of terrifying.
Right. It's scary as a designer to.
Yeah, that's what I mean by it. Is like I want to give somebody like a completed product primarily so that they can't like have a go at me for not having properly done my job.
We talked about it in the past where it's like, we were dissecting like what Gaslands might be if we were to iterate it again. And we kept talking about the first touch like of a player first interacting with the game. They get it out, they read the rules, they try and play it with their friends who also don't know how to play it. And like, does it feel like crap the first game? And therefore essentially you've lost them as a player. And that like that's completely alien in a world where you're saying, well, here's some ideas to add to your table.
Hmm. And I think like certainly RPGs continue to sort of have that thing where they say, well, here are some story hooks. Here's just an idea of what might be developed into a story. And obviously,
here's an entire book of monsters or encounters or treasure. And it's like, do what you like with that. That's just more paprika.
Yeah. And as I say, the idea of a board game doing that to you, you'd be like, what are you even thinking?
Right. Because it's sort of, it's intent. We have become trained to consider it as self-contained and discrete.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, like, for these sorts of games, the campaign area and the scenario bit, maybe we can get a bit, fruity there of going, well, here's some ideas for some scenarios. This is a scenario that I like to play, but why not create your own scenario? And okay, here's what a campaign structure might look like, put together your own one.
That's right.
But the idea of going, okay, here are the core rules of this game. Here are some ways shooting could work. One of my favorite films is the film Clue. It's the board game Clue, and it has like several different endings. And if you
watch, that's got one of the world's greatest performances of all time.
I think it's got a few of them, but I think I love Tim Curry in that.
Yeah, Tim Curry's like insane mania. I need to watch that movie again. I'm going to go put that on.
And when you watch on DVD, you get an ending and then it says, that's how it could have happened, but what about this? And then it shows you another ending. And the idea of going, okay, here's a shooting phase. It could work like this, but what about this? Why not consider turning this knob?
And that's super common in these 70s rule books.
Mm,
Super common. It's like, here's a rule system, but also like Jeff down the road plays it this way, and I showed it to Phil and he just said, no, I'd use this rule, and that's brilliant, let's put this in the book as well.
I know, and the idea of as a designer putting that out, like, that's the intention is, why not twiddle some of these knobs, why not tweak some
but
of
I think them? I think that's one of the things that I find super interesting about, like, if you're drawing a spectrum with role-playing games and boxed games on either end of it, and like, we're creating in this medium where like it isn't clear whether we're supposed to allow that sort of latitude or not, because like in a role-playing game, obviously if you don't like a rule you ignore it, if you don't like a rule you make a different rule. In a board game, like, no, like maybe after 2, 3, 4, 5 games you house rule something because you just don't like one particular aspect of it, maybe you change the setup so you've got more cards or something. But like, in this middle point, the thing that we're making, like, it is, I don't know, like, it's maybe kind of, I feel like in the 90s, it was quite common to see, like, hey, if you don't like any of these rules, like, just ignore them or make another one up, like, it's your table. But I think you're right, like, fast forward 30 years, and that, like, isn't really something that games designers put in their introductions so much anymore, of like, you know, it's intended to be a machine, and if you pull cogs out, it probably stops functioning. And we caution, like, you know, feel free to feel free to house rule games, but start with the scenarios and the peripheral levels of the onion. Don't like just go in and start monkeying around with the machinery straight away.
And I think a certain amount of it, in a way, for me, it's about sort of whose game is being played. And the thing about RPGs is that you're playing your games master's game.
Yeah.
You know, they're given some guidelines, but it's their game. They're creating at the table for you. You go and play a boxed game. The game is that designer's game. He's given you all the stuff. You play it in his way. These sorts of games, I feel, are our game, me and you, me and the person right across the table. And because of that, what I want the rules to be is a language for me and you to speak to each other and to communicate across the table. And if I think that my rule set might be like for tournament games and pickup games, I want that language to be quite sort of a lingua franca between strangers at times, and for them to go, we know what the standard set of words are. We'll use those because we don't know each other that well. And if you're with friends and if you're all chummy and you're all happy around the tabletop, you can start using your own slang and altering and twisting it. And I think possibly back in the earlier days, there's this thing of everybody is friends, you know, yeah, when they're playing these games. Everybody all the time are always friends. You're
all on the side of the game working rather than an outcome for you.
You all know each other. You're all chums. The idea of turning up at an open play store and grabbing like an army out of the figure cabinet and just playing a game with a stranger is just like.
And I think that's maybe a super interesting topic to dig into on a separate occasion of like, you know, chess tournaments are obviously fine because the rules are completely discrete and known. And like, why do we continue to be gravitating towards, you know, like, what is it about the sort of the vast infinity of miniature games with their non-discrete movement and their funny terrain and their models that don't have the same shapes as each other? Like, what is it that drives us to try and make that a competitive experience? It's obviously great and we love it, but like, where the rule systems aren't complete enough or discrete enough, it's super interesting. But we probably don't need to unpack that now.
No, and for me, it's those sorts of attempts aren't about writing a competitive tournament scene game. They're about writing a casual pickup game that operates.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe you might want to try and run a tournament at your club, but really it's like, I'll shoot for tournament level tightness. That probably means it won't fall apart in a pickup game, and no one's ever going to play it in a super tight tournament anyway. It's not going to get that big, but that's what I'll aim for, and then I'll fall somewhere where it's a nice tight pickup game that strangers can play without having to like have pistols at dawn in the car park because they don't understand what I meant for them to do.
And I think that's like for us, it feels like that's the sort of heart of it, which is in a world where everyone's friends, you can get away with this sort of loosey-goosey or leaving gaps. But if you want the hobby to be inclusive and you want, you know, disparate people to be able to interact with this as their communication medium, then you just need to provide more certainty, more confidence. Like, I couldn't play. So I'm trying to remember the name of the game that I played. I have played a board game that I knew quite well, but I can't remember it right now, with a man in Japan who spoke no English. I spoke no Japanese, and yet we had a perfectly reasonable time playing that game. We both knew the rules, and so we were able to interact with that entirely sort of discrete language that was presented on the tabletop. There's no way we're going to play a miniature war game, the majority of miniature war games, with no shared language of any kind. And so I think that's sort of where that maybe ends up. You know, if you're going to get the majority of people in, or you're going to be able to get people of more disparate sort of backgrounds to actually have a good game together.
Yeah.
And just not rely on that trust relationship already existing, because clearly it won't if you've just met someone.
Yeah, and equally, and the other thing it makes me think of, and I have to sort of pass this over relatively swiftly, is that, you know, we put out games and then we get total strangers coming back to us saying, what was your intention for this particular rule? And the answer is, yeah, well, my intention was for you to have fun. Have fun with it. And it's like that there are people quite reasonably who don't just want to know, like, what is the rules as written here? What does it appear to say in plain English? They want to know what you thought, what you as a designer had in your heart and mind when you were writing this, because it puts me in mind of the old school revolution in RPGs. A lot of people want to feel like they're playing Gaslands at Mike Hutchinson's table, you know, and they want to know what Mike Hutchinson meant for them to how Mike Hutchinson wanted them to have fun. And they want to play with you in the way that you meant to play. And what they really don't want is for you to say, I really don't care how you play, mate. I'm not coming around your house. I'm not the game.
Right. And you've mentioned it a couple of times, and Sean Sutter has mentioned it in other forums as well. Like, the games designer role is in many regards the game master role. Mm-hmm. And I like that idea that, like, in a collaborative role-playing game, like, it could maybe be our game, but it never really is. It's always the games master games. They always get the final say. And in a boxed game, it's that person's game. But I think you're absolutely right. I think it's like, if you've built like a trust relationship between the designer who seems to be giving you a fun time and the players who want to have a fun time, then it's sort of like, it's disappointing if you're like, well, I'm not the architect of fun. Like, I came here to be entertained. Like, why is the movie asking me to fill in the character dialogue? Like, that's no good. You fucking do it. It's your job. And so I think you're right. I think it's like, the less ambiguity and the more completeness you provide, the more confidence you give to the player that they are experiencing the game in the best possible way, rather than always having the nagging sensation that they took some ingredients and just made like a mediocre chicken korma out of it when they could have been something brilliant.
Yeah. And it's tough because, like I say, to sort of go back to, you know, I hate to go on about it, Alex Kennedy talks about microfiction. And what he says is that it's great when a player fills in the gap between parts of two bits of fiction, because they own the gap. That gap is theirs, and it belongs to them. It will forever. And it's lovely if you can say, okay, this is a space between two things. This, I put this here for you to own. That's for you to play with. It's an issue though when you leave a gap and the people feel like, I don't know what's meant to go in there. I don't want to own it. I don't want it to be mine. I want you to have filled it in for me and for me to walk over it smoothly. Mm. And being able to communicate that sometimes this is a space and room for you rather than something you need to feel afraid of stepping into. It's a tricky balancing act. So something
anyway, so I think that's something I've been musing on. I'm intrigued by. I don't know that it changes my perspective particularly on the modern craft, but it certainly gives me an appreciation for sort of that transition from the 70s into the 90s.
Right. So now that you have successfully covered yourself against your next rule set having huge gaping loopholes, that when somebody comes back to you and says, there's huge gaps in this rule set.
I know, it's a period piece from the 70s.
It's all intentional. It's for you to own the game yourself as much as it belongs to me. It's essentially an art piece in a miniatures tabletop game. We will sign off this conversation. I'm sure that people watching this have created not just their own like rule sets and scenarios and house rules and games, you know, and have often found games that needed a bit of patching over, needing a bit of filling in. When have you found a gap that you loved sort of creating something for? What's your favorite house rule that you created for a game that you vastly improved in your opinion by doing so?
Yeah,
and what is your feelings about a game intentionally saying, okay, here's a toolbox, here's a set of options, here's things, build whatever you like out of it. Is it a good idea in the modern day? Is it something that we've maybe lost? And is it a good or a bad thing that we have or haven't lost it? Hit the like and subscribe button if you've watched through to this point.
We literally can't feed our children unless you hit that like button.
Don't just drop comments in the comment section, drop comments in the Discord. That way a whole bunch of love.
That won't help the YouTube algorithm.
But
do it as well.
They're a lovely
just because it's fun and we like to hear.
there are lovely people in there having chats about all these sorts of subjects, and they will respond to you as a hive mind of splendiferousness if you stop in there and make comments. Look us up on social media, reach out to us. But
not that I've posted on social media for a good 2 years at this point, but
I have people to do that, but but yes, attempt to look us up. People will hand us your messages on a silver platter, and we'll shout responses at them, and they'll type them in for us. But generally, this conversation, I think, is at an end. It was incomplete, but that is the way of it. So it'll be
we got 80%. We'll leave the 20% to you. You fill it in.
Exactly. That's the whole point. But for now, it'll be thank you and goodbye from this episode of Rule of Carnage. So thank you. And
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.